This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and we are now just a few short days away from Christmas 2018. And if you haven't yet purchased the item that you want for Christmas, it's probably not too late yet to go ahead and check out theperfecttrick.com. They are the sponsor for the Magic Word Podcast, and we certainly appreciate you patronizing them, so this way they will continue with their sponsorship with this podcast. We thank you for going and visiting that website, and also thank you for going to the Amazon.com website. If you're going to be buying anything through Amazon, through our banner here at the bottom of the page at themagicwordpodcast.com. What? You're not aware of that? Well, you should be. It's something that I hope you don't overlook. Please just go to the website, and you'll see at the bottom of any of the pages a banner there that says affiliate of Amazon.com, and by clicking that, it will take you to Amazon, and anything that you purchase then will benefit the Magic Word Podcast. So all of your sales is appreciated, and I know that Eric Citron, our friend over at theperfecttrick.com, will appreciate you clicking on his website and purchasing something over there as well. Well, this week we are going to be talking with Bill Ragsdale. Now, let me just explain a little bit about this particular podcast. It was interesting because, of course, just recently I had attended Magic Cuba, and it was fantastic, and you can go back and listen to any or all of those episodes, and I talked with several people throughout each day, and kind of, as usual with the convention, give you daily updates and reports of what's going on. Well, on the very first day, or I should say, actually, before the convention actually began, I ran into Bill Ragsdale, who happened to be wearing a baseball cap from the Magic Castle, and so, actually, of course, it identified him as being a magician, and I had already been there for a while, a day or two, and he was the first magician I ran across. And so he said I was intentionally wearing this hat, hoping perhaps someone might recognize me, a magician, and stop and talk. And so we did. So I just chatted with him a little bit about what was going on and why he had come to the convention to Magic Cuba. But what I found interesting was that he also teaches a class on lockpicking at the Magic Castle as one of their perks. Occasionally on Wednesday nights, they put together a great thing for their membership, and those who want to sign up can come on Wednesdays for special occasions that they have or classes, and one of them is this class, again, that Bill teaches on picking locks. And he is an expert in this and gives us some advice and also some websites that you can go and visit to learn through some YouTube videos and other places so that you can learn to pick some locks also. But anyhow, it was such a successful class that he was teaching. He's been back several times to teach. And if you go to themagicwordpodcast.com and see this week's episode, you can see some of the photos that were taken there at the castle, by the way, then too. I know a lot of you listen to this podcast through iTunes and other places and actually don't necessarily go to the website, but I always like to encourage you to go there for additional content. Also, after I had finished, again, I was just going to add this as being part of the daily update for Magic Cuba. So after I said, well, thanks a lot, then signed off, then we continued our conversation. And as we were talking, he was talking about John Scarney. And he was saying, well, you know, I'm the world's leading authority on John Scarney. And I said, whoa, back up. Let me turn on the microphone again. He had given a scholarly talk at one of the Magic Collectors meetings out in L.A., Los Angeles Conference on Magic History or whatever. I'm not exactly sure what it's called. Anyhow, he was one of the presenters and afterwards was asked, why don't you put together a book on that, which he did. And so it's available. And there's a picture of that, and I believe I'll have a link on that website, our website, to go and purchase that from him if you're interested. But it's quite interesting. And as we were talking on this, we kind of just continued to talk more about John Scarney. And I learned a lot about him that I didn't know from before. And one of the things, by the way, too, were the reasons that Bill Ragsdale had come to Havana, not just for the convention, but because that John Scarney had spent a lot of time in Havana. And in fact, when he was at the Hilton Hotel, he often would stay in this same room. And so he wanted to have a picture taken outside the room, which I did. I went up there with him and took a photo of him standing out front of the door, which was right next to Fidel Castro's room, where he had, after the revolution had taken place in the 50s, had stayed in this room and put together his team, I guess, And for a while, they continued to allow gambling in the hotel. And I say a while, I don't think it was but about a month or two. Nevertheless, there are a lot of interesting stories that Bill has to share about John, and some of the things are in the book outside of what he discusses here. But it was quite an interesting discussion that we kind of got into. So if you enjoy history about card expert John Scarney, I think you're really going to enjoy this. And if not, you'll learn something along the way then, too. So please welcome my guest, Mr. Bill Ragsdale, this week on The Magic Word. All right. Well, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word podcast, and we're sitting out on the veranda on the terrace here overlooking the ocean behind the Nacional, Hotel Nacional. And the first magician that I met, we're kind of the advanced team, as you said, from California, is Bill Ragsdale. Hi, Bill.
Hi there, Scott. Great to meet you here.
It's a pleasure. It's the first time we had met. I just saw your hat. You were wearing a Magic Castle hat, and I thought, oh, there's a magician.
So. And what a glorious place to meet, right here on the Malecon in Havana, Cuba.
Yes. This is going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to the convention. Well, I want to talk about that in just a minute, but I was fascinated by the conversation that we just had, and I want to kind of recap some of that, that you teach a class at the Magic Castle on lockpicking. Right. So tell me a little bit about what that's about.
We fell into this just kind of by accident. Sitting at the bar about a year ago, I was talking to a couple of friend magicians, and I had worked as a locksmith in earlier years, and we talked about lockpicking. And they said, please teach me. So I took two of them aside. We went to a cafe a couple days later, and we taught them how to pick locks. And they said, you ought to be doing this for more people. So I approached the castle board of trustees. They approved, and they said it'd be fine. So we do an evening lockpicking lesson. It's called the Lockpicking Lesson for the Curious with Bill Ragsdale. It goes 2.5 hours, paid registration. The class fills up in generally about 2 weeks, about 2 months ahead. When they come in, it's a very social activity. At the beginning, we do 15 minutes of videos, which are very humorous. They're lock picking, lock destroying, lock attacking videos. And then about 15 minutes of a trivia contest that's all about locks and security. And then we do about 15 minutes of a handcuff picking competition, where they take essentially play children's handcuffs, form teams of four, and pick their way through these handcuffs for a prize. Then they attack a clear plastic lock and three others. So along the way, they have contests. There's three different contests. They win champagne, they win books, they win flashlights.
All that's included in the cost of the
All included. Yeah. And when they go home with a set of lock picks, a clear plastic practice lock, a DVD with instruction books, and a four-page cheat sheet. And then we wrap up the evening with a ceremony at the end. And I won't tip too much about it, but they get a personalized memento at the end that is really, for most of them, it's really quite meaningful. They really like it. We've had people who missed a class earlier, and they heard about it, and they said, please, I want to get a copy of that memento myself. So basically, it's a social event. We do it usually two nights back-to-back, like a Monday night and a Tuesday night, which are slow nights at the castle, and schedule them about every second month, every other month. And so far, about 150 people have gone through the class. And by next January, we'll have over 200 students that have gone through the lockpicking
class. And you say that it fills up pretty quickly.
Yeah, it fills up, kind of how you judge it. The class fills up in about 15 days, 2 months before it's scheduled to occur. And then you start to get the emails about people saying, can you sneak me in? Or has there been a cancellation?
Right. And you got a wait list.
We have a wait list on it. And it's actually quite important with the wait list, because these are part of the fun is we're competing in teams of four, and we need to have every seat full. So if somebody cancels at the last minute, we do have a wait list where we can bring somebody in.
But. And you were saying that they work with the handcuffs as well as, I mean, padlocks and house locks and everything, I guess.
The event is gauged for success. We want the people to be able to open the locks. And so if we used hard locks or tricky locks, it would be very, very frustrating. So we gauged it so that most everybody opens up everything. One of the introductions I say, is at the end of this evening, you'll be able to open all desk and cabinet locks. You'll be able to open a lot of padlocks, and you'll be able to open up many, many door locks. But right. When it comes to door locks, you know, you'll need a good bit more experience. From a handcuff standpoint, we actually play a handcuff game which uses a children's handcuff set. It's a set of four plastic handcuffs. Some of them are apprehensive about putting on handcuffs and trying to open them, but it's rated for children age 6 and up. So I tell them, you'll certainly be able to handle it. So they put these plastic handcuffs on, but they go through a full, legitimate, realistic picking exercise to open that handcuff without using a key.
Right.
And once all four team members escape, then they qualify for a prize.
Wow. You know, I was thinking what you mentioned about it's important that you not discourage people. You want to make it not too easy, not too difficult. A few years ago at Magic Live, have you attended Magic Live?
Yes, for the last 4 years.
Okay, well, do you remember the one they did then was the locks and the boxes?
49 boxes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was awesome. And I was talking with one of the guys who put that together, and he said that there's a fine line to try to make it so it's difficult enough so it's not frustrating and people give up. If it's too difficult, then they kind of say, okay, well, I can't do it, and they walk away. But, and also to have it done within a certain amount of time as well. I understand they did this with the Magic Castle. Also, Joe Furlow put that together for Member Night.
Yeah, they did it, and it's been repeated a time or two in other venues around Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But they did it at the Castle, and I participated in that at Magic Live, you know,
that was fun, wasn't it?
4 or 5 years ago, and it was absolutely intriguing because it had a fair intellectual component to it, other than like puzzles.
Yeah.
But
as
again,
a locksmith, also, you must have
fighting the time limit, though, because I think they had. Was it just an hour or so
to do
it?
An hour and a half, something like that.
Yeah. And it really would be more like a full evening. You know, our teams got maybe out of the 49 boxes, I think we got maybe 32 of them open in about six or seven. You know, there just wasn't enough time.
Right, right.
But so we try to do something like that in this lockpicking thing, is to make it very social, very fun, plan for success, and...
Do you find, what is the age group? I mean, do you seem to have more older people, younger people, men, women, boys, girls? I mean, there's some junior members. What's the mix?
The stated profile is members and member guests, members and spouse guests. So they're all supposed to be registered members of the Magic Castle. But some people do bring an unaffiliated guest, and frankly, that is great. You know, but. It's a very castle-centric thing. The age brackets are mainly who can afford $55 and a midweek evening and a friend, and you have to have all those things at the same time. So most of the people are, I would say, age 40 and up.
Okay.
John Carney was one of my students just recently, but the peak is people who have the disposable income and the leisure time, and in the 60s, 50, 60-year-old. Also, the kind of people who are the backbone of magic clubs are the people who are, you know. And we've had people there, though, they're into their 80s and had married couples who were more than elderly, and they all enjoyed it. We do a survey at the end, a checkbox survey, and out of 24 students, we normally get about 22 that rated as excellent, and then one or two don't reply. And the other day I got one that was very good. It wasn't excellent, it was very good.
Okay.
And that, you know, that caught my attention.
Well, different people have different rating scales, you know, as to what they will determine. Something has to be perfect all the way around for it to be, give it a 10, you know.
Yeah, I have a direct marketing background, and we do surveys like this. If you're doing a professional job, you really expect everybody's really going to like it or better like it. And if you have any noticeable numbers that are like so-so, not so good, you've got to examine what the program is. At the end of it, I tell one of our little magic jokes. I say, it's been my pleasure to serve you this evening and introduce you to lockpicking. If you had a good time and you found this was social and fun and rewarding, then my name is Bill Ragsdale, and please tell Joe Furlow or Ben Roman, who are the managers.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if this was kind of a drag and a waste of time, and you wish you'd been watching Penn and Teller, then my name is Steve Valentine, and tell Jack Goldfinger.
Yeah. You need to speak with an English accent, don't you?
And they love that. Yeah. They love that.
Yeah. Well, now we're here, of course, for the Magic Cuba. And what was it that attracted you? When did you first hear about this? And why did you register?
My daughter. Okay. My daughter, who's a magic, she's a magician member of the Magic Castle. She's 35 years old and has attended SAM meetings for 35 years. When she was born, she would crawl at six months old. She would crawl underneath the close-up tables while the magicians were doing close-up. So she was raised in a magic family. And she saw that on the Facebook that said, magic in Cuba, and she said, we're going.
Yeah.
So my wife and I, who are all magician members, we said, let's go. So
long way from California.
It was the magic and the thrill of Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's a chance in a lifetime to come because, you know, there's great difficulty in getting to Cuba. You have to be affiliated with a cultural event to be able to come here.
Mm-hmm.
And at no small amount of paperwork and travel. And
that's for sure.
You know, we came in through Mexico and we went through immigration three times on the way, things like that.
You didn't come straight from the U.S.? You went from Mexico to here and then you go back that route?
Yes.
Okay.
From Sacramento, California, where we are, Aeromexico was the only single company that would come the whole way. Uh-huh. Otherwise, we'd have to drive to San Francisco and come in another way.
Yeah, see, I came on Southwest, and it was direct, but had a layover in Fort Lauderdale, and then came in from there, from Houston, Texas.
That's it. Yeah, I think we saw those, and, you know, the travel time was like 14 hours or
wow.
25 hours or something, because there was layovers.
Okay, yeah. No, mine wasn't. I think I had a two-hour layover, so it wasn't too bad.
My daughter came in on JetBlue from Los Angeles, and it was perfect. It was.
But the lineup sounds tremendous here.
Matt King, everybody's looking forward to Matt King.
Of course.
he can perform anywhere, anytime, fill the room.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Well, Bill, thanks very much. It's a pleasure meeting you and chatting with you.
Well, Scott, glad to. Hope we've kindled the art and magic. One last little fill-up on this, and that is, I've been professionally involved in locksmithing, and I didn't realize over the last 25 years it has become a recognized hobby. It's called locksport.
Did not know that.
Coming from Holland and Germany, they have an association and they have local chapters. And in the United States, there are 25 chapters, and they meet monthly all around the country. And I tell my students in the Magic Castle in Hollywood that in North Hollywood, there's a monthly meeting of the lockpicking chapter for locksport, so they can carry on their hobby on a local basis in their hometown.
Wow. Interesting. For people to get to, and where can they join? I guess there's an internet or a website I guess they can go to? Or?
There are about three Facebook pages that are primarily Europe-oriented. They're managed out of England. That are locksport, but they typically have maybe 3,000 members to them.
Yeah.
The most notable YouTube page is a gentleman named Bosnian Bill. Bosnian Bill has put out 1,300 YouTube videos.
Wow.
And he has 300,000 followers.
Wow.
Unbelievable. The close second or the runner up is called the Lockpicking Lawyer. And so you can look up either Bosnian Bill or Lockpicking Lawyer on YouTube, and you'll get a total education right there.
Wow. Well, there you go. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Bill Ragsdale. Scotty out. So as we're sitting here and enjoying a mojito and the sun going down, across the Atlantic over here, or Caribbean, I guess. It is the Caribbean right here. Aren't we at the Caribbean, actually?
Well, it's the Florida. The map right here calls it the Florida Straits, Straits of Florida.
Okay, there we go. Well, it kind of bends, though, around over there. It looks like it's not real straight. Anyhow.
Well, that's what's on the map, anyway.
So as we were chatting, then Bill was mentioning to me that he is the authority on John Scarney. So I thought it was kind of interesting because you said that you also talk or have given talks at the collectors' meetings that they used to have, Magic Collectors, about John Scarney and published a book finally on that.
Oh, my gosh. Here we go off on another tangent. My mother gave me my first magic book when I'm 13 years old, and it was by Card Tricks by John Scarney. Still have the book. Signed it when I'm 13 years old, so I'll have the book.
He signed it?
No, I signed it.
Oh, okay.
Now, it turned out in later years, in my late teens and early 20s, I worked in Las Vegas at a casino supply company. And I had the happenstance to meet John Scarney one time at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. My boss and I were on a sales trip, actually through the Caribbean, but we stopped in New York City. And my boss was a close friend of Scarney and made a dinner appointment. And so Scarney said, I'll meet you for dinner Tuesday night, whatever.
What year was this event?
66.
Okay.
So we met him in the lobby of the hotel, and he said, gentlemen, I am really sorry. He said, Hilton called an emergency meeting on me. I've got to go to them. He said, I'll have to take a rain check on dinner tonight, but maybe next time you're in town. Well, there never was a next time in town.
My.
But at least I met him there. Well, with that kind of a kickoff, later years, I collected his books. He's written 14 books and has developed some 20 or 25 games. And
I will have one more mojito.
One mojito more?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
And the key to John Scarney's life was developing multiple streams of income. He realized that he couldn't just be a platform entertainer magician because the hours are irregular, you're doing evening smokers, as they called them in those days, gentlemen's clubs, you're doing ladies' luncheon clubs. And there was no TV, there was no internet, there was no radio, and so it was really hard to get steady employment. So what he realized was he could diversify. So that's why he started writing books. He invented games and he wrote books to get a royalty income over the years. And along the way, he had a newsletter, John Scarney's newsletter on Half Magic, Half Gambling.
It went out to who?
Subscribers, paid subscribers. It was printed monthly, and you subscribe for a year, and then at the end of a year, there's a renewal. There was a 13th issue for renewal, and then at that point, they realized there was not enough subscriber base to carry forward, so it ended. And so I have the only complete collection known to exist in Scarney's newsletter. But in addition, his material was then excerpted from his books into magazine articles. He then performed on television. He was on everybody's show, Merv Griffin, Johnny Carson, all the rest. He was advertising authority or embarked on advertising because he was doing advertising promotion for his games and for his books. So he had all of these careers interwoven to build a stream of income. But the goose that laid the golden eggs was Hilton Hotels. So he worked for the better part of 20 years as a casino consultant to the Hilton Hotels. And what brings it home to us sitting here in front of the Nacional Hotel was that the Hilton Hotel had built the new hotel in about 1957. And they brought Scarney down to be the consultant on it because they realized that organized crime was going to be playing a key role in managing the casinos, and there's nothing they could do about that.
In Cuba or Vegas?
In Cuba.
Okay.
In Cuba. And the core belief of the Italian gentleman who ran the gambling here in Cuba was, do not cheat the public. Now, there had been gambling here in Cuba before they came in that was flagrant cheating, fleecing the public, and a lot of ill will. And when the Vegas-oriented kind of operations came in, they realized we have to make an honest game out of this because we can make so much money here that don't mess it up by cheating the public and getting a black
eye. We can make honest money, basically.
We can make honest money.
Ah, okay.
Well, of course, they made their real money by skim. So what would be was they would sit in the counting room and they would count out enough money each night to pay their operating cost, and they would report that to the government and they would scam the rest. So, and you can go into any number of books that we'll discuss all about that. Well, the links I have with that was that a gentleman named Jake Lansky was the manager at the casino or parts of it or pit boss or whatever at the Tropicana during this time period. And later on, as I traveled with this company I worked for that made casino equipment, we came to know Jake Lansky because on Curacao, he was running the Curacao Intercontinental Casino. So I've had a couple dinners with him and his wife, totally on the local business there, nothing about the background. And then along the same linkage to that, the Nacional here was off and on managed by a gentleman named Jake Lansky. Well, Jake Lansky was the brother of Meyer Lansky, and Meyer Lansky is notorious in all of the organized gambling circles as the chairman of the board, if you will, or the commission. He was the guiding light that put good business practices in on essentially what is a dirty business. Well, Jake Lansky was his brother, and we would sit in Vegas at the shop where I worked, and here Jake Lansky would be calling in to chat with my boss. And so these two old gentlemen would chat. This was many, many, many years after Cuba. But they would get to chat and reminisce about all the old days in Cuba. So here I am on a spiritual journey to come back and visit the hotels where I have these acquaintances and linkages.
You must have heard some really good stories.
One that's a cute one to tell that doesn't involve any people.
Being killed or anything.
Well, no. But this is just a cute one. The key product that this company made was Ewing Manufacturing, run by a man named Slim Ewing. The key product that they had was called the drop box. This was the steel box with high security locks on it that goes under the gambling table. So when they take your money, they push it through a slot in the table into the box.
Right.
And Slim Ewing invented this in 1948 in Vegas, and we won't go into that because that's another long story. But he would then be selling these around the world to casinos along with other casino equipment. Well, on the original design, it had a small front door lock with a security key lock on it. It would take the box off the table, go in the counting room, and take the money out. Business was so good at these casinos in Las Vegas, they would open up the door, they would hold the box up on the counting table, and they would shake the box, and the money wouldn't come out.
Because it was so stuffed.
It was stuffed in there. It was arched and tinted and packed in the box after a good night. So they would come to Slim and say, Slim, the edges of that box and that door, we go in to pull the money out by the handful, and he said it catches on our French cuff sleeves, and it's fraying the sleeves of our
Can
sleeves.
Can you improve this?
Could you improve the box? And so my old former employer, Slim, would just look at him with his little steely eyes and say, take smaller handfuls.
That's your solution.
And they would hate to be accused of greed, so this was his way to chide them to get back. Actually, ultimately what he did was he developed the second generation version, which put the door on the side, and now you could shake the money out and it was just perfect.
It seems like you could put something on the other side, you can push it out, you know, but anyhow, that's pretty cool.
Another little side one that is a cute item is, why did the drop box get invented? Well, Slim Ewing was playing 21 in 1948 in the Golden Nugget Casino in Las Vegas, and in those days there was El Rancho Vegas and the Golden Nugget, and that's all there was in Vegas.
That was back when Bugsy...
Before, that was three years before.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Back before. Bugsy came in like 53, 4, 5. One of the pit bosses was talking to Slim Ewing and lamenting and chatting. Slim ran was a locksmith. He ran a lock company in Bakersfield, California, but he also ran slot machines and pinball machines. So he was kind of a gambler in the same profession. So the pit boss was lamenting to him about the people that were stealing from him. And they said, Slim, he says, they just kill me around here. He says, what happens is they take this money box off the table, which was made out of wood by the carpenter, and they had locks on it from the local hardware store, Von Tobel's hardware store. Well, you go down to the hardware store, and the locks they sold were all keyed alike. So when you bought 10 more, they all had the same key. So in the hotel, they said, if you went to Von Tobel's hardware store, you could buy a key to the money box on the tables at the Golden Nugget Casino, and employees would do that. So on the way
just
back...
Just a generic lock.
Or a
key.
Generic lock.
Key,
and on the way back from the table to the cashier's cage, security guard could open the thing up and take money out and lock it up again, or he could take a pocket comb and slide the pocket comb into the slot and rake a bill out.
Wow.
Now, he might get a dollar. Get a 20. Who knows? It might get a 20.
Win the lottery.
He might get $100. You never know what you're going to get out of that box.
Wow.
So Slim took that information back to Bakersfield and said, well, I can make an industry out of this or a product. So he then made a metal box that had security locks. When it goes on the table, it's locked on the table, and it takes a key to get it off the table.
Okay.
And the action of unlocking it from the table pops a metal slide. So a metal slide goes across the slot and locks so that you no longer have access to the slot in the top of the box. So now the box is a totally sealed steel.
So once the money goes in, you can't stick anything else in there unless you have one of those little plastic things to stick in it, or what?
On the table, you push the bills in, and you could pull a bill out when it's locked on the table, but you're then in full view of everybody in the casino.
Ah.
See? And they have a plastic paddle sticking in it anyway.
Right. It stays there, right?
Yes. But yep. Once it's off the table, then you want to make it impervious to tampering. So then the slot would be locked shut automatically as it came off the table. And it took a separate, different key to open the money compartment. And in some casinos where there was a dual control, they would actually put two locks on the money compartment, so you had to have two people there to open the box.
Now, is this part of your background as a locksmith that you kind of went to work for this company?
Well, here we go. I'll try to make it short. I'd had a background in locks as a curiosity. Coming out of my second year of college, I bumped to a traveling locksmith who had a Muni bus that had been converted into a mobile lock shop. And he traveled Central California doing locksmithing in unincorporated areas where he didn't need a business license. So he would travel around on a route about every 3 months, circling Central California, pull up for about 3 days, and then just do locksmithing, would come in the door, and then drive on. So I went to work for him one summer, and we toured all around California. I went to work for him the second summer, and he said, "Bill, I want you to meet the world's best locksmith." So we drove to Vegas in his lock shop, mobile lock shop, and met Slim Ewing, who technically probably was one of the best in the world. He was called a locksmith's locksmith because he would do the hard stuff the other guys didn't know how to do. Mm-hmm. And so then from then on, I worked for him for the rest of the summers, and he became a very close family friend. He was in my wedding party when I got married. I was when we drove on our honeymoon, he drove the car away. And I was a pallbearer at his funeral 40 years later.
Yeah.
So
wow.
He was a mentor.
But this all started with John Scarney.
Somehow it all fits together. So I wrote a book about Johnny Scarney. I went to Jim Steinmeier's Magic Conference on Magic History in Los Angeles in about 2014, gave a presentation on Scarney, and then took that material and wrote it into a book. Mm-hmm. And now that book's available on eBay. So all of you who are listening can go on. You just go Bill Ragsdale, John Scarney on eBay, and you get a copy of my book. And they're all autographed.
And it's how many pages? About 70 pages?
78 pages. Okay. Spiral bound, informal.
Are they tricks that John is about his life, or what's the content?
You know, John Scarney had seven careers. He had seven business careers that that I mentioned on this advertising and publishing and games and all that. So what it really is weaving the seven threads of his life together, but with color photographs. He was in movies. You know he was the hand double in The Sting. For Paul Newman.
I think I remember hearing that. You know that John Calvert was a stand-in for, who was the guy that was in Gone with the Wind? That played Rhett Butler?
Oh.
We're both having a brain fart here.
Moment. Anyway.
He filled in for him. Yeah.
So with John Scarney, his first movie was in 1929. He was in a short subject for Robert Benchley called Dark Magic, which occasionally appears on TBS TV to this day. Hmm. And then in the 50s, he was in a documentary for the Navy. And then he was in a 1930s movie. In England, it was called My Country Bumpkin. I forget the U.S. name of the title. But he basically did magic clips, short things in movies. So the book is all about those seven different careers. But it also takes his biography, which he wrote, The Amazing World. He wrote two biographies, The Amazing World of John Scarney and then The Odds Against Me. Two different biographies, one in 2000, one in 1955.
Autobiography.
Yeah. One in 1955 and the other one in 1965. So I take his book and do an annotation to it. I take page by page and write about one or two lines about what he's saying on each page of the book. So instead of reading the book, if you want to locate something, you can go through the annotation.
Why did you find him so fascinating? What was it about him that captured your attention?
Gosh. That's a hard one. I don't know. Maybe just because he was the first magician name that I knew when I was 13 years old. When I got the book that my mother gave me that was by John Scarney. Somehow that was the continuity to it. Then also at the end, there's an index of all of his tricks. so it covers everything that's in print that is by or about John Scarney, including all the DVDs, the movies, magazine clippings, ephemera. He did a number of shows for SAM National at national conventions, at dinners, and we've got pictures of him performing casually and informally, as well as in major events. So it's a rich collection.
Well, you say that he had invented games also. What kind of games? I don't you mean like card games, I assume, like for Hoyle or something?
Originally, he did board games.
Really?
And only board games. And in his biography, he said, "I will never do games with cards or dice because I don't want to present a lure to children
for gambling
because they would associate games, children's games, with dice or cards." Turns out later he did do some cards with dice, some games with dice, but they were mainly board games and kind of puzzles.
What were some of the games?
The first game that he did, the second game he did was called Tico, and the first game, I'm going to take a moment for me to think of it. It turns out James Braddock, the Cinderella man, was a two-door-down-the-street neighbor kid with him, and they grew up together. They were the same age. So when they were 10, 12, 13 years old, they pal around together. And later on, when Braddock became a heavyweight champion of the world, Scarney was kind of hanging around the boxing camps. The two of them together did a boxing game. It was kind of like Monopoly, but the whole board is all about boxing events, bouts, rounds, punches, and so on. And so you would play around the board playing this board game, and it was by the Braddock Scarney Game Company out of New York City, and there are only two copies known to exist. One of them is complete, but it's for sale for $3,000, and I just couldn't budge for $3,000. And I have a copy of the board only, which I got on eBay for, I think, $100. But that was his first game. His second game was called Tico, T-E-E-K-O. And it's a simple board game. Originally it was a 4x4 board, and then it migrated to a 5x5 board. And he claims he sold 200,000 copies of it.
Wow.
And if you look at magazines in those days and articles and advertisements, it was well promoted and well known. It went through about four major printings and revisions, four or five, quite a number. So he sold it over the course of 20 years. And then he has another one called Follow the Arrow, another one called IQ, Scarney's IQ. So they were mostly kind of games with checkers and markers and moves around the board. One of them was a solo game. It played on a board that was 5x5, 25 squares, and it was a solo game. So you would put down numbered markers on the board and then try to arrange them in a pattern, and there were winning patterns to go to. But it was a solo game. You just played it by yourself.
Do you think that he knew who Erden Ace was?
He claims he got his start with Erden Ace. And
from the book or from knowing him?
Oh, no, not knowing. Well, no, nobody knew Erden Ace.
I thought maybe he knew him and died without telling.
No, nobody knew Erden Ace. But Scarney and I, he has been known to embellish material in his books and combine things that happened at different times for the editorial benefit and clarity. But he does say that he had Erden Ace's book when he was young, when he was 14, 15, 16 years old. But he did learn his original material by watching local gamblers that would, they'd be in public or they'd be in private games, and he would haunt them and watch them and kind of figure out what they were doing. And then he worked as a delivery boy in a company that made illegal gambling equipment. Well, they made gambling equipment. So they made dice. They sold dice and cards. You could get straight or you could get crooked. And the major business was selling loaded dice and marked cards to gamblers at that time. So that's where, and this, he was 19 years old. So this was how he got his start.
That was his world.
That was his world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now he had his mother who...
Did he go to school or anything?
No, he dropped out in ninth grade.
Okay.
Ninth grade. Freshman year of high school. Math was his best subject. English was his worst. On the other hand, he said, how can a guy whose English was his first language class write 14
write books?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny.
But it turns out the way he wrote the books was original books were an ass told to. So there was a policeman named Audley Walsh, who is not the guy that invented the expanding cane.
Not the Walsh cane, okay.
But it's the other Audley Walsh, who was a policeman in New Jersey that was a friend of Scarny, that was an amateur magician friend also. And so Scarny had the first book on three-card Monty, and it's as told to Audley Walsh. So the title of the book is John Scarny's Three-Card Monty as told to Audley Walsh. And so it's not quite his book, but his pictures, his words. So he said all the stuff, and Audley Walsh wrote it down. A couple other books later, essentially he was co-author. He would find somebody in the gambling community in the New York area in the 30s, and they would pull material together from a variety of sources, and Carney would be listed as author. Oh, and in fact, a couple of them, John Carger, who was a photographer for Life magazine, was a co-author on a couple of his early books. And of course, he was the lead three tricks in Stars of Magic. Originally, the theory is that they wanted Dive Ernan to be the lead author in Stars of Magic with his tricks. But the behind-the-scenes word is that Scarny, because of his promotion, had a bigger name, better name known in the magic community at that time than did Di Vernon, because Scarny had been doing this for 20 years.
And that would have been about what year, approximately?
I guess Scars of Magic came out in 1949, maybe. Somewhere around in there, late 40s.
Vernon was just making a name for himself.
Yeah, when he just came in from Canada, and you know, he worked in construction for a number of years.
Well,
and,
for a short and, time, yeah. He broke his arm, I understand. Yeah.
And he, actually both arms, I understand.
Yeah.
But he was a nightclub magician doing Harlequin act. He was doing a Harlequin act in nightclubs, mm-hmm. and he really wasn't known to, quote, the boys, as he was later on because of his productivity. So the word is that Scarny got the first three articles in Stars of Magic just because it was sold originally as a series of publications, month by month by month. You'd subscribe and you'd get issue one, issue two, three, four.
And what do they include in the newsletters? I mean, do you talk about tricks or how to shuffle or?
Well, no, they were individual tricks. Like one of them was it's a routine using rubber balls in a net.
Oh, sure.
The triple coincidence, and then a copper silver were, I believe, the first three. And they were sold on a subscription basis, so you really needed a name to sell the first copy. So if the first copy came out by John Scarny,
right.
People knew John Scarny.
The advertising gene and the gen and all that, I guess, back then.
Back
Sphinx.
Then. Yeah. And so then it was a series over the course of a year or so, and then they combined all of the loose pamphlets into a bound book. So you go on eBay and you can still
buy it. Kind of like Tarbell, I guess.
Yeah. Well, same idea that Harlan Tarbell had. So with Scarny, you go on eBay today and you can buy the original pamphlets. They pop up for $10. You know.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah. But
you got a complete collection of all.
No, I don't have any of them. I have the book.
Oh, the book. I'm sorry.
The book, Scars of Magic.
Yeah.
Why, you know, only a solid collector would, you know, want to buy the individual pamphlets. So I never thought about that. I should get Scarny's pamphlets for the collection. But I have all of his games, all of his books, many copies. A number of them are signed which one was it? I guess it was on one of the... I can't remember which one was signed. It was signed to his co-author. It was signed to Mr. Don Commute, who was a co-author on one of his games. And what it meant was this fellow had actually written the instructions. Scarny did the game, and this was his co-author who did the instructions. So I have a number of his material that's, you know, signed to... let's see, who's the fellow who wrote, was a shadow? His wife was...
Walter...
Gibson. Walter Gibson. Yeah. So I have the copies from Walter Gibson's collection that John Scarny signed to him. So he said to Walter Gibson, with great honor, you know, please take my book, John Scarny. And then Scarny wrote a book on gambling for women, and so Litska Gibson, who was Walter Gibson's wife, I have a copy that addressed to her from John Scarney. And I don't know how in the world these got on to public auctions or onto eBay. Mm-hmm.
But again, we were talking about the newsletters, and you were saying that they include tricks and things in there, like, say, balls and net and other kinds of... Was it just like a four-page newsletter or something?
Well, the newsletter that he did was not Stars of Magic. The Stars of Magic was...
Separate, of course.
But on his, again, you sell what you know. And so in those days, you know, this was in the 50s, he was a consultant to Hilton Hotels, and so he had a lot of fresh gossip about what was going on in the gambling community. And
were there casinos you were talking about in the Hilton?
Casino gambling, yeah. Okay. It was casino gambling. So he would write on casino gambling, name-dropping on famous people.
So-and-so, yeah, right.
And on a major event that had happened at casinos, if they'd had a big hit or a big win. And along that time, Ed Thorpe came out with the book Beat the Dealer, on how to beat System 21. So Scarney had a number of issues in his newsletter were about how these guys who wrote these books on Casino 21 or Beating 21, Scarney was better. You know, they didn't really have the full answer. That, you know, the only way to get the full answer was read Scarney's stuff, because what they were putting out was partial or not quite as good. So then he got into a words of war with Ed Thorpe. And they had a $100,000 contest that they proposed, that they were going to meet at a casino, and it was a set of rules. They were going to play sudden death for 21, and whoever won the $100,000.
Wow, that's a lot of money back then.
Well, it was. And so they are. But again, this is PR. This is John Scarney promotion. See, it's getting newspapers, getting ink.
Right.
And so they argued back and forth for a number of months on the rules and venue and all that, and it never happened. It didn't, you know, it didn't happen. The other half then of Scarney's newsletter was on magic tricks, magic effects, and he would teach magic tricks, and or he would talk about, I guess, magic happenings and events. So this went. He had a co-publisher on this. So another gentleman, you know, I'm sure did all the printing and the mailing and the subscription fulfillment, and Scarney just came up with the material. So it ran for 13 issues, as I said before, and that was the end of it. There is a electronic source called Library, I believe it is.
Lybrary.com, yeah.
Yeah. You can get the issues, the full set of John Scarney's newsletter from Library, because I donated the PDFs to them. I PDFed it and sent it to their library. And they also have all of John Scarney's books there available. And very nominal, for about $10, you can get any of his books.
What's one of your favorite tricks you like from the books?
The one I do is Triple Coincidence. It's a right blend of multiple revelations, a setup deck, and a sort of a degree of skill level. So it's a balance between the skill level is not too demanding, there are multiple revelations, you interact with the audience nicely, and there's a case where with the audience members. So you have a deck, the audience member has a deck, you take three cards out, give it to them, they take three cards out, give it to you. Okay? And you reverse them. So you reverse their cards in the deck, in your deck, they reverse their cards in their deck, you stack them together, and then you fan them out, and they all match. That your three cards are exactly suit and value for the three cards that they picked at random.
Right. What book is that from?
Stars of Magic.
Okay.
Stars of Magic. Triple Coincidence. And so it's got all these elements in it where the other people handle the cards, you handle the cards. It's got the three different revelations to it. And the technique is well within anybody's skill level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not the ambitious card or something like that.
Now, you said you spoke at the collector's meeting not once but twice?
No, once at the Magic History Conference. And then it was so well received that the castle, they said, well, we do a thing called a perk there, which are free events generally non-revealing for all people who can attend. In other words, it's a walk-in type of an event.
For members, whether they're magicians or not.
Right. And if non-members walk in or guests walk in, that's fine too, because you don't reveal any magic. And a lot of times they're on exactly this topic. They're on history, they're on personality, they're on notable events in magic. And so I packaged this up and did it as a perk at the Magic Castle. And then I have to present it about 3 or 4 times more at magic clubs around Western United States.
And then you put it into a book.
And then I wrote the book. Well, then along the way, I wrote the book to memorialize all the material. So anyway, it's been fun. It's a fun ride with John Scarney. He did not do any books aimed to the magic community, magic fraternity. His two books on card magic, which got combined into a third volume, he had Scarney's Card Tricks, and then it had more of Scarney's Card Tricks, and then it had a combined volume of all that material. Was all for the general public, and it was no slight material.
Was he married with children?
Yes. He married, her name was Norma Kearney. When they married, her name was, her name she went under was Steffi Storm.
Okay.
And I don't
know. Sounds like a weather forecaster on television.
But she was Steffi Storm when they married, but her name was Norma Kearney. She was 31 when they married, and he was about 55, and she was his secretary. A vivacious red-headed Irish lady. We've been in touch. She still survives.
Oh, okay.
I believe she still survives. He passed away in 1982, but as of 2016, she's still alive because she was only 31 when they married.
Yeah, right. And children?
They had one child, Tico, John Tico Scarney.
Not named after the game.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Same spelling.
Yes.
Okay.
Because Scarney was such an egotist that he had to have his child perpetuating the name of his game. And the kid's name would have been Tico Scarney, but the priest would not baptize him in the Catholic Church unless his first name was a saint. So they named him John after John Scarney, but there's no Saint Tico, so they could not use that name for baptism.
That is funny.
Unfortunately, the child passed away at the age of 25 from cancer, and so it's a sad point. The name Scarney has an interesting story behind it. He's Orlando Carmelo Scarnaccia was his given name. His folks migrated from Italy in about 1885, 6, 7. He was born in 1903. He has an older daughter, Lucy, who was 2 years older, born in 1900. So they're both raised in the U.S. And in school, his name is Orlando Scarnaccia. Well, 6, 7, 8-year-olds are going to tease somebody with a funny name. So he changed his name to John originally. So he was John Scarnaccia. When he started performing, he changed it to John Scarney for billing purposes.
Mm-hmm. And lived where? What part of the country?
Fairlawn, New Jersey.
Okay.
He's born in Fort Lee, New Jersey, is where his grave is. And his son, he buried his son there with a huge marker that's like 8-7 feet long, wide, with embellishments and decoration in honor of his son, who, you know, he cared deeply about. And then he has a small marker that's right on the side of it that then says John Scarney, and it said, well, world's greatest authority on gambling and magic. That's on his headstone.
Right.
But it's basically a major...
Not too much of an egotist.
Gravesite to his son, but then he went along for the ride. People say, ask me, if John Scarney... You know, magicians often really are not successful financially. They really have a problem from the cash flow standpoint, and very few of them die wealthy. You know, you can probably count on the hand of one hand on the ones we know of that really died wealthy. To answer that question, when John Scarney passed away, his car was a Rolls Royce. It had a license plate of Tico on it. And he owned two condos in Florida where his wife finished out her years. One of them was lived in, and the other one was kind of a museum filled up full of memorabilia of John Scarney. So it was his wife residence and then a tribute museum. And then he has royalties to this day. So she has income from publishers, not from the games. The games all faded away. But if you still go to this day, you can get Scarny on poker. Mm-hmm. And
she gets a piece of that.
Still, and she gets a, you know, she'll get 75 cents a book or some number, everyone sold. They've been updated along the way, some anonymously. As far as I know, his name is still the author, but they've come along and added more games to them that are a little more contemporary. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think Hold'em was as hot back, it was even known in those days. And so,
Texas Hold'em, you're talking
about? Texas Hold'em. So his books have been updated. But there's still a cash flow because he was a very good business head on his shoulder. Mm-hmm. All through World War II, he volunteered for the U.S. Army doing educational training for soldiers because he became aware of the amount of cards, marked cards, and loaded dice that were being sold to GIs as they left for service. They would get drafted, they would go to Gambling Supply, buy crooked material, go into service, and their occupation in the service was cheating other servicemen. So he would go on formal tours all around through service installations doing gambling exposés.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as a result, he met a lot of famous people. He stayed here. He stayed at the Hilton Hotel here in Havana. And Castro had a room on the 24th story. And he had what is loosely called a boom boom room on the 15th floor, which was next door to John Scarny's. So Scarny was on room 512, and the boom boom room was on 514. And Scarny would, on numerous occasions, do card tricks for Castro. And the Russian ambassador came through, Anastas Mikoyan, and so Fidel set up a meeting for Scarny to do card tricks for the Russian ambassador.
Wow.
He did. He also did magic for three presidents.
Yeah.
Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower. So,
in the Oval Office, or I mean, they're somewhere in Washington.
I would assume it would be. I don't think they would come to him. So I assume it was at some event where, you know, he was featured.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he had an amazing life.
Very colorful career.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, the cornerstone financially was a consultant to Hilton for 25 years. So he would do about 1 week out of six for Hilton, and then when the Hilton was operating the hotels, the casinos here in Cuba, he worked full time for almost 2.5 years.
Huh. Okay.
They ran for about a year. The revolution took place. The casinos were closed for about 9 months, and there was because it was the gambling was against the philosophy of the revolution, but there were some 900 employees who were laid off from the hotels and the casinos, and they petitioned the government with such force that Castro relented, and they reestablished gambling back in the hotels in Las Vegas for about another year and a half.
Wow.
And finally then, on New Year's Eve, 1957, with the last night the casinos ran, because on New Year's Day 1958, the Barbudos, the bearded ones, came into Havana, and the revolution hit Havana. And Batista had left town that night. He left town on January 31st, 1957, with his kids. And the next day, overnight, they heard Batista's gone, and that means the revolution is over, and it's hit Cuba. So
it's now it's Fidel.
Yeah. And they continued to run for a brief time thereafter, a matter of weeks or so, closed down, and then came back again about 2 years later. And mm-hmm. Scarny was their eyes on sight here for the hotel, keeping the games honest. And there was, we won't go into all the details on how they handled the money. We have to read Scarny's books on that. But he talks about how the royalties and the commissions and so were paid. But by the time after the revolution, the casino revenue dropped so dramatically that they had an $80,000 a month fee to Hilton, and that was dropped down to about $20,000-$25,000 because the level of support just wouldn't pay it.
But this Hotel Nacional was actually owned by the Hilton back then?
No.
Separate.
The Hilton Hotel was owned by a local union. It was a local employees association. It was a Cuban hotel workers union financed it, kind of like the Teamsters financing Las Vegas. It was an investment for pensions for the union. was also a front, though, for organized crime. And the Nacional was owned by the government, I believe, but then some group came in and raised money and purchased control of it. And then they were the hotel owner, and then casino syndicates, you know, crime syndicates came in and managed them.
Right.
So
right.
All the major hotels were run by organized crime. If you want to read the book, read Little Big Man, the story of Meyer Lansky, Little Big Man, and that'll tell you all the details.
Yeah, I've heard or seen some movies, I guess, you know, where the Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack used to come here to that.
In The Godfather, Hyman, I forget his last name, not Olkin, but Hyman.
Oh, yes, Hyman, yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Anyway, that was the Lansky character. He was mischaracterized because at this time Lansky was about 55 years old.
And it made him look like he was 75.
Yeah. That was Hyman Roth, was but in the movie he was elderly. And on his, you know, very, very senior years. But Hyman Roth was the Godfather One character. But the books are very, very...
Since you've been here, have you taken a look at where the casino used to be in this hotel?
No, I've just been here 2 hours.
Okay.
And I've been here 4 hours, and two of them has been enjoying our conversation,
yeah.
Scott.
I'll tell you what, then we're going to wrap this up. But I tell you what, that the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to ask my guests, what is it that's your philosophy of life? What is it that you live by? It doesn't have to be a word, it's a phrase, it's just something that's important to you.
Be systematic and follow systems. Now, that's... It's not... The basis on this is that I innovate very little in my life. But what I've found is processes or systems or methods that have been proven elsewhere that you can adopt. And so I was trained formally as a statistician. So we would follow a statistical model and then go off and apply that to a job, an industry, an application. For a while I was doing... with a company doing manufacturing control, and we put in a computerized manufacturing system that was extremely systematized. So, you know, I'm not too humorous, I'm not too innovative, not too clever, but I can follow a system and follow it. And as a result, I retired at age 55.
Yeah. So get a system and follow it.
The system worked.
Yes, right. Yeah. Great. Bill, thank you very much. It's been fascinating. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
That was a hard question. That was a good answer. That was
That's true. It's over the Magic Word Podcast. Again, that was Bill Ragsdale. This is Scotty Allen. Well, I want to thank kind of an unexpected guest, Bill Ragsdale, for being our guest on this week's podcast on The Magic Word. And thank you very much for sharing many of the stories. That was pretty fascinating. And I hope you guys learned a lot there as much as I did. That was, as I said, pretty fascinating. Thanks a lot, Bill. And if you are a member of the Academy of Magical Arts, you might see about going to his lockpicking class to learn a little bit more. I suspect that the best place you could go would be to contact the Magic Castle and find out when they're going to be having another one of these classes, and hopefully there'll be room that you can slip in and go and learn how to pick locks. And also, again, if you're interested in his book, just go to our website, and there'll be a link there where that you'll be able to go and find a copy for yourself. It's kind of a spiral-bound book. It's a short read. It's very good, but very detailed, and a lot of information in the back also as to where he's crediting this and where all of his information comes from. So I want to thank you guys again for listening. Next week, we'll be wrapping up the year with our last podcast of the year. This one is number 466, and next week will be 467. How about that? Wow, we'll keep on clicking, getting closer to the 500 milestone. And also, we want to thank you for going and patronizing theperfecttrick.com, the sponsor here at The Magic Word. And thank you, Eric Citron, who is the owner of The Perfect Trick. .com for being our sponsor. And also want one last reminder to go to our website and click on the banner whenever you're going to be using Amazon. And also, if you haven't purchased your 2016 Magic Calendar through Amazon, you can click on that. There is also a link on the website that you can go and order your calendar to hang on the wall. Pretty darn cool. So I think that's probably going to be a wrap here for this week. And until next week, stay well, get booked, and develop a system and stick with it. This is Scotty out.